You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 16th of November 2013 on Monocle 24.
A delectable detour into the world of specialized publishing, setting sail for the Icelandic capital and reviewing architecture in print. From Turin to Paris via the South Pacific, you're tuned to The Stack, issue 64. On today's edition of The Stack, we have two editors to guide us through some of their top magazine picks, and we'll also be setting up our tripod in Paris to frame the perfect picture with French title Polka.
It's important to show to public and to the young generation what is a good photography and how it makes a difference.
And we'll also be stopping off in Turin, where a small periodical celebrates the best in graphic design.
And this is a magazine very particular because every month they ask to a graphic designer to fill these 16 pages in the way they want, completely free.
All that and much more in the 64th edition of The Stack right here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio One here at Midori House. I'm Tyler Brûlé, and you're listening to The Stack, our weekly review of print here on this very channel. It's a bright, sunny and frosty one here in London this morning, but it's all warm breezes and South Pacific holiday cheer on the cover of one of my favorite titles that's just landed on my desk. New Zealand Life and Leisure may not win any design prizes, though it did just win Newsstand Magazine of the Year in its home market. But it's one of those journals that makes you want to pack up everything you're doing and start looking for a new business to launch on Waiheke Island or Hawke's Bay. This magazine has nothing to do with the likes of the new independent lifestyle journals like Serial or The Weekender. It's commercial, bold, a tad mumsy, but it also knows exactly who it's targeting. In the November-December issue, you can read about protecting ducks, growing lavender, planting trees, and at the turn of every page, you can, for a moment, check out of wherever you're currently residing and live like an upper-middle-class Kiwi. Perfect. That's my weekend tip for reading. Now, let's meet our guests. And joining me around the table today is American writer and editor Erin Spence. Now, her husband Davey was on The Stack last year. They're the founders of Boat Magazine, which set sail, I believe, in 2011. Now, for anyone who's not familiar with the title, and I want to get to the bottom of really where the name came from, but it's almost like there was a, and this is just if I can imagine, if there was some discussion in the beginning, you have to almost think a series of editors have this wonderful vessel and they pull up in port, and so far they've been to the likes of Sarajevo, Detroit, London, Athens, most recently Kyoto. And now they're really in the middle of the rather rough, I would say, North Atlantic at this time of year. Reykjavik is on the horizon, Erin.
Yes. Well, we actually just got back. We've just sent the issue to print. And we spent a few weeks there in October kind of uncovering stories. And yeah, but is in terms of the name, We started as a design studio called Boat Studio, and we had a slow month of business, and we just decided, let's take our team and go somewhere and do something interesting. And we went to Sarajevo. None of us knew anything about it. We thought, let's just spend a month there, meet the locals, gather some stories, do some illustrations. And we came back to London with a ton of stuff, and we made it into a magazine called Boat Magazine. And we didn't really expect it to sell or for anybody to really be interested in it, but it's done fairly well. And so now here we are with a magazine called Boat, and we get put in the boating section. We probably change the name if we had it to do over again. But
based on that, because you know we run a not dissimilar business here, agency and also a magazine, what's pushing harder now? Is the agency still the core of what you do and Boat is a wonderful portfolio for the business? Or is there a nice competitive tension between the two?
Yeah, it started definitely with the studio, but the magazine's slowly taking over, and I guess the studio now does almost solely publishing type jobs and editorial type jobs. So it has kind of eclipsed our other work, which is fine.
So tell me, how does the process work? We'll maybe come back to how you ended up with Reykjavik, for example. Mm-hmm. But is it five, six of you descending on this place, then also trying to actually uncover photographic talent writers when you get there? How does the editorial process work?
Well, once we've decided on a city, we kind of just start digging around from here. People that we know who've been there, people who we might know who are already there. And we kind of start drawing up a story ideas list. And then, but it's really pretty loose. Once we get there, then we meet with the people we know and just kind of go off in a million directions and find whatever we can find. And then we try to work with the local talent that we find when we're there. So we try to do a 50-50 kind of split of outsiders coming in and writing and talking about what we learn, and also locals talking about what it's actually like. And that the inside-outside view kind of helps in keeping the coverage balanced. So it works pretty well. Usually we only take, when we get there, well, if we have a list of 50 stories, we'll only use one or two of them really in the magazine. Almost all of the content is decided once we're there.
Mm. And how's the mood in Reykjavik? Here is a place which really became and took some, you know, not great global headlines for, you know, a complete economic meltdown, bank mm-hmm. collapse, etc. Mm-hmm. But a lot of what we've been hearing as well is that it's been a huge reality check. You've seen Icelanders really quite literally going back to the knitting. And I'm wondering, you know, how do things feel? And is there a certain sense of buoyancy there?
Yeah, well, we'd heard about the knitting, and the first coffee shop we walked into, there were like four people sitting there knitting. So we're like, wow, it's actually true. But the thing that we kept hearing the most, almost everyone we talked to specifically about that said, the good thing is that people are starting to look at creating as a way to make money. And that's really happening. We profile a couple artists, and one of the artists that we talked to, Thorin's amazing. She's just gone to where the aluminum factory is, and they've kind of taken all the jobs from the area, and she's trying to come up with some products to design where the local talent and trades that are there can be used to create more income and diversify the jobs. So I think people are really thinking in terms of what can we make, what can we create and do that will bring revenue in. Yeah.
Will Hunter is also around the table. He's the founder of Alternative Roots of Architecture, ARFA, or ARFA, a think tank exploring alternative educational models, former editor as well of the monthly magazines, The Architect's Journal and Building Design. He's now the deputy editor of the Architectural Review. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
You've got quite a significant pile of titles in front of you this morning. When you look at the state of the newsstand right now, or certainly titles that come across your desk, and then maybe I would imagine when you're aggregating stories and figuring out where you want to work, it's quite interesting now with what happened with architecture firms' websites, mm-hmm. the level of sophistication, sort of the push for dynamism, and I wonder, do you think that's actually affected the Architecture Journal, how they have to play today in the market?
I think so. I mean, I think the things that I've brought in are about print. Mm. So I've looked at the Architectural Association in London and two of their magazines that are print-based. And I think that, websites have definitely changed what we've done just because the sheer volume of stuff you can find globally now, that we've much more focused on the writing and criticism rather than just the image.
Mm. And when you have really the world at your fingertips at any moment, I wonder, does that also sort of affect the metabolism as well? Because obviously there's always the long view, and of course, you know, buildings don't go up overnight. Well, maybe in some corners of the world they do. But I'm wondering if that also just affects just the traditional editing, where something goes versus, the competition of all of these screens in front of us.
I think it makes the spread of architecture around the world and the ideas kind of placeless at times, that you can just rip off ideas without any context, so that a building could be in Beijing or Beirut or wherever, and it doesn't really kind of, it can just sort of slot in. Mm. So it's not specific to a place. And I think that is a kind of problem in terms of how you treat architecture.
And does that also then present an opportunity, you think, for print today as well, that it maybe forces some titles or opens the door for titles to maybe give a spread or two more to critique that wasn't there before, that there was maybe the tension that you would have between image and words. And maybe does it actually sort of allow print to do what it's really good at in the best architecture journals?
Definitely. I mean, we've found that we've started running 10,000 word essays and they've been really popular. We've sort of tripled our approval rating since we've done that. Mm. But actually, people really want content and not just images. Actually, to think deeply about architecture requires a sheer length of word length you can kind of explore those issues in.
Mm. Aaron, you said that with your firm as well, you're doing a lot of custom projects. And I'm wondering, what is the relationship like with clients right now? I mean, certainly one thing that, you know, that we've heard and we've seen a lot of businesses, you know, that they talk about, you know, what was their custom publishing business, and there was this great rush to go to the tablet, and then a realization that, you know, not everybody has a tablet, and yes, they might want to interact with the brand, you know, online, but also a lot of companies actually coming back and saying, we want a magazine again. It seemed like a really good idea 8 quarters ago when someone was looking at the numbers to just, you know, get rid of print altogether and cut contracts and crazy paper bills and all of those things. And now there's a move back. And I'm wondering if you're seeing that on the agency side of the business.
Yeah, definitely. We definitely have, which I still find is kind of surprising because of how many voices there are saying it's all about digital. But yeah, definitely. I think that I personally think part of it is that there is just so much online. It's so difficult to get through to what you're looking for. That actually print, you know, if you can get that in front of somebody and it looks really good and it is in the vein of what they're interested in, they're probably going to pick it up. And the chances of them doing that online and finding that online is actually really slim now. So I think it's almost due partly to the sheer volume of stuff and noise on the internet that they think we can kind of cut through that now with publication again, which is just a bit odd, but...
As we ease into the weekend, Will, I wanted to start with you, maybe not looking at the titles you have. Well, we could if we want to, but maybe your weekend print diet. And I'm wondering if that sort of changed over the years, that, you know, clearly one would imagine there's a keyboard and a screen involved Monday to Friday, if not, you know, all, you know, across all 7 days. But if you could maybe just share with us, you know, what happens on a Saturday or a Friday evening, newspaper-wise for you, you know, just actually aggregating your news. And if, you know, Saturdays and Sundays, you know, are a time for all of the things you have in front of you today.
No, I mean, my weekend diary probably comes across as fanatically right-wing. So it's The Spectator and The Sunday Times. And they are, I mean, I read them because I think the writing's really good and that they have just...
You don't have to be apologetic, it's absolutely fine.
Well, no, but I...
Even though you're on the left side of the table, but that aside.
But they allow completely different voices in it, particularly The Spectator, that allows just the voice and the commentary of the opinion writers to come through and that it is about the writing. So I switch off architecture at the weekend completely.
Aaron, you?
I usually keep a stack of magazines throughout the week to then... troll through over the weekend.
And top picks for you?
This week?
Yeah.
This week I'm reading Another Escape that just came out, and that's another indie publication. And it's started by two Bristolians, and they basically kind of go through the UK, and they've started going out into different countries as well to find people who are doing something that's just outside of the 9 to 5, something they're really passionate about. Yep.
We'll come back to that. We don't want you to give it all of that away. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. We're going to come back in a moment. It's Off to Paris. Now, this weekend, Paris Photo, the biggest photography fair in the world, has gathered the world's most important art galleries under the glass vault of the Grand Palais. But one magazine has also managed to squeeze its way into an exhibition booth created by Alain Genestar. The former director of Paris Match, Poca magazine, is a quarterly publication that aims to report current affairs through photography. The founders of Poca also run a small photo gallery nestled in the heart of Paris's third arrondissement, where they say they want to tell the story of the world through images. Our Daphne Dennis headed to Paris Photo this week and caught up with Edouard Genestar, the publisher of the magazine.
Poca thinks that we had a part, that we could help photographers to produce and also to show to the public, with the magazine and with an exhibition, the work of the photographer, the young and also the classic one, those who have success, recent success, but that are very big and talentous photographer.
So which photographers do you work with here? Which photographers are in your magazine and which photographers are you showing here at Paris Photo?
All the generation. We are interested by, of course, the best one that, like Salgado that we are exhibiting. Or like Marc Riboud, Elliot Erwitt, William Klein, Peter Lindbergh. Because they are masters. And it's important to show to public and to the young generation what is a good photography and how it makes a difference between the wall photography you can see on the internet and that are not professional and that are not the same quality. We are also interested by the young photographer or the people that are beginning in the to work as professional, and we try to help them by publishing or exhibiting. And this is very interesting because the technology of photography is evolving, the diffusion also, and so there is a new way to photograph and to produce. So it's very inspiring and it's now open to all creation. And that's why photography now is a big success over the world. Everybody is interested by photography.
Everybody is indeed interested by photography, but at the same time, photography is a very, very difficult medium at the moment because obviously, because of the internet, we find photographs all over the web and paying for a photograph has become increasingly complicated. Most newspapers go and take agency photographs, for instance. So you're trying to stand out from this and actually buy photographs, commission photographs. How does that work and what's your budget behind that?
I think there is one problem with the internet, but it's a recent problem, but it's also a solution. Internet is evolving. There is a part that is free, but we know now that we can pay also on the internet, and perhaps some photographer will take advantage of it. On the other part, yes, there is a competition, because now everybody can take a picture, and so it's difficult for a professional to sell its photography and to justify. But as I said, there are masters and there are talented photographers, and this is not for everybody that can get to this level. And that's we think in Polka that there will still be place for professional, and now it's a problem of budget. For the magazine and also for the exhibition, we dedicate a budget for production in order to make photographers work and also to help them, and also to have exclusivity. And I think the mean of a media, a part of the media, is to get exclusivity, is to have its own point of view, and to be at the origin of a subject, or to have it before the others, because it's a good competition between medias to offer to its public something with quality, originality, creativity, and with sense. And in Polka, we refuse to take only what we see on the internet and to accept it as it is. We think that it's not the way press should work, because the truth is not on the internet. The truth is when you explain it, when you justify it. So there is a work behind it. In our pages, we have a rubric dedicated to new technology and internet. And you can find also very interesting things that come from a very big, far away of the world. And that is the interest of internet. But before publishing it, we address to the photographer. If we discover it on the internet, we talk to him and we try to understand its work. So that there is always a work behind.
And in terms of the distribution of the magazine, how many people have you managed to reach?
The circulation is around 50,000 in France, and a bit around Europe and big capitals. As you are a radio from London, you can find it in Eurostar if you come to Paris. And Polka, as we say, is quite universal because photography is universal. So perhaps one day we can find it in English.
And on the long term, obviously, this is an interesting project to have a gallery and a magazine at the same time. So what's on the long run, what's your vision for the future of the magazine? What's your aim? What would you like to achieve in terms of circulation, but also the reach of your magazine?
It's a long-term project. So the achievement for the gallery was to be in Paris Photo, because it's the best recognition you can have in art and representation for artists. for the magazine, but it's to have a better circulation, but it's to be on digital network. Already we are on iPad. And as I said, one day to be in English.
And that was Edward Genestar, publisher of Poco magazine, speaking to our Daphne Dennis. And there'll be more from Paris Photo when on our Rob Bounds Culture program. It's going to be Monday evening, London time, 1900. And you're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24. Interesting that they were saying numbers of 50,000 for quite a specialized title. One might have to investigate that. You were smiling when you were just looking through the magazine, listening to the package, Aaron, and I'm not sure if you were smiling because you thought, well, you've got Boat magazine and you end up in the nautical section of the newsstand, and whether they're in the competitive dance section as well. But what did you make of Poco as you were looking through it?
It's really beautiful. Yeah, the photos are really beautiful. I found it interesting what they were talking about, just the whole issue of photographers getting commissioned and paid for their work. Because that's a theme, obviously, we have to think about a lot as an independent publication. And two of the ones that I've brought in as well kind of try to tackle that issue. Mm. One is about interns and interns getting paid. And then the other one is a documentary photography special about, you know, where is the quality photography going to go because these budgets have been cut. So I think that's a really important issue. Mm. Yeah.
Will, what did you make of it?
I mean, I did. If you hadn't told me it was about photography, I wouldn't have really had a clue that that was what it was about. Mm. I mean, it's all in French, so I can't read any of it. But flicking through, the graphic design doesn't say to me this is about photography. It looks like a sort of National Geographic.
Sort of lighter current affairs magazine.
Sort of, I don't know, it feels quite old-fashioned to me.
It's amazing. And at the same time, he was referencing, you can find it at the Eurostar station. It's incredible in France, unlike this country and maybe, you know, many other English-speaking markets, just the amount of new commercial magazines like that are coming out. I mean, the relaunch of Louis France, French Vanity Fair, French edition of Elle Man. So despite sort of all the bad news we hear about France, it seems that the newsstand is in rather rude health. We're going to take a very short commercial break. We're going to get into all of the magazines that are assembled around the table right after this.
The Monocle Book Tour has touched down in the warmer parts of the globe, and this November we'll be packing the snowshoes and chilling out in the Nordic region. Starting on November the 18th in Stockholm and taking in a different country each day, we'll be shooting through Oslo and Copenhagen before ending up in Helsinki on the 21st, and we'll be bringing you live shows right here on Monocle 24 from each stop along the way. So if you want to hear how the Monocle Guide to Better Living is going down in the snowier parts of Europe, point your mouse towards book.monocle.com and be sure to tune in to Nordic Leg of the Monocle Book Tour this November on Monocle 24.
And you're back on The Stack here on Monocle 24, the special 64th edition, our weekly print review. Of course, today I'm joined by Aaron Spence, editor of Boat Magazine, and Will Hunter, who is the deputy editor at Architecture Review. And we were looking at some of the titles that you have in front of you, Will. One very interesting one, which we were chatting about a little bit earlier. Maybe tell us about the first two titles you want to talk about today.
Well, I've brought in two titles from the Architectural Association, which is a very international architecture school. And I was quite interested in, I mean, I've just launched a School of Architecture from a magazine, so I was quite interested in how a School of Architecture might launch magazines. And actually, what's interesting about the AA is that it has something called AA Files, which is its quite establishment academic journal, but it also pays for these anti-establishment publications to happen as well, and that these are not really commercial propositions, but they kind of define a moment. So the first one was called Narrative Architecture Today, NATO, that was in the mid-80s, and it only had three issues. But it kind of set up a whole intellectual position about redefining the city and how you might represent architecture. And then the other one is called Fulcrum, which is a current one, and it's a weekly free sheet that was set up by a blogger, but he felt that he had to have a kind of paper publication to give it critical weight. Mm. And both of them are about establishing a kind of critical position. I find that really interesting.
Maybe just from a format point of view, just set up NATO for us first. And maybe you say that the school finances and supports this. So what happens? Do, you know, a body of students have to pitch an idea, or how does that actually function?
NATO is really interesting. So NATO is a unit run by a studio run by Nigel Coates, and all his students failed one year because James Stirling was the external examiner and said this work is unassessable because it was all paintings and there was no plans or sections. It was just kind of these sort of weird situationist views of what the city might be like. And then Alvin Bajarski was the head of school and actually managed to pass them all. And then he said, listen, we're going to give you some money and you can do a book because I need to prove that you were worth saving. And Nigel said, no, we'll do a magazine instead because it's more immediate. And they did three magazines that had exhibitions, but also installations in the city. So it was, a strange aleatory way of setting something up.
And then that was it. It sort of, it marked its moment in time and then it was done.
Well, but actually Nigel went on to become Professor of Architecture at the Royal College of Art. Robert Mull was a founding member who's now head of school at London Met. So actually these people who did this anti-establishment route then went on to become quite, not establishment figures, but have completely changed the discourse through this kind of momentary publishing thing.
So tell us about Fulcrum and maybe the evolution of that.
So Fulcrum started by Jack Self, who was an undergraduate a few years ago, and he's from a kind of writing family. And I think it started much more as a kind of conversation amongst the students. But actually, since then, it's really established his position. And he writes for lots of other people. But he's also brought in like an amazing global network of contributors who, you know, you email someone in China or America and say, I'm the editor of the AA's weekly paper, and they take it really seriously. So he gets these amazing contributors to work for free.
And from a format point of view, it is literally just that. It's a paper.
It's simply one page, printed on less than A4 size, printed on two sides, and the colour of the paper changes every term.
Aaron, a little bit earlier you were touching on a title launched out of Bristol, which it's interesting that Bristol is maybe a little bit of a publishing hotbed, because I was also talking about Serial at the top of the program as well, also from that city. Let's go back to the title you were talking about.
Yeah, well, I guess I'm kind of interested in titles that probably wouldn't be able to exist in a really super commercial way, and Another Escape is definitely one of those, in that they really just find interesting people who are doing things that they love, that they're passionate about, and that definitely operate outside of the kind of 9-to-5. So they're kind of finding, well, what used to be alternative lifestyles, and talking about those, they're becoming more mainstream, I guess, that way of living and working. But Another Escape is just really beautiful. It's really well done. And yeah, it's just a collection of profiles, really beautiful illustrations and photographs of these interesting people. In the last volume, the one I just got this week, the story that I really love is about people in the UK who find and make dyes and pigments. And just kind of, you know, it's one of those things you don't really think about, the ease of sort of how colourful our life is now, and how back, you know, 100 years ago that wasn't as possible. And now it's just these people. It's a guy who's a seventh generation miner who goes down in his spare time and collects ochre. And it's just one of those kind of professions that you don't really think about. And they try to uncover those types of things.
When you look at a title like this, do you feel it also steps on your patch that you're in? Do you look at this from a competitive point of view?
No, I don't really. Maybe I should a bit more. No, I guess just because Boat's quite, we have a really specific sort of format, I guess, in that our entire issue is about one city. So in a way, we go to a city and we try to find similar people to who they're talking about. But they've done stories from all over the world. So I guess, no, not really. Maybe I should, though.
I'm always interested in financing models. So, you know, as you said, Boat launches and you know, obviously has a great reception in the marketplace. When I look at it, I think one of the exciting things is it's not very dense in advertising. And as you said, here's a title that you launched when things were a little bit slow and you all decamp to Sarajevo, which makes me think, well, things couldn't have been that bad if you were able to go to Sarajevo. I imagine there's quite cheap flights on Wizz Air or however you want to get there.
Right.
how does it work? I mean, how does this, you know, come together?
So the studio subsidizes the magazine, so we front the money we rent a house in the city that we're going to, and contributors come out and meet us. We all crash in the house, and then the studio funds the printing, and we just hope
to recoup 5, 10, 15. How many people?
It has varied. I think Reykjavik, we had, I think, around 10 people come out over the course of the few weeks that we were there. And then, yeah, then the studio fronts some money for the print run, and we hope to recoup it in sales, which we have in most cases, not all cases.
Right. So. And is it? Are you editing out there live, or is it a case of then coming back to base in London and saying, this is what we've collected, and you know, maybe using the luxury of distance to reflect on it, or are you starting the design process while you're out there?
No, we do start it when we're out there, especially with Reykjavik. We had a pretty tight turnaround. We were there in October, and the magazine comes out next week. So we had to when we were there. But yeah, actually, I think it is a little bit better when we can come back and kind of think about it and work on it from there. But half of the contributors are Icelandic, so they are already working on it when we're there. So I can kind of keep it rolling, yeah.
Another title. Those are your first two. What do you want to turn to next?
Well, I'm interested that you were saying you've brought magazines that are not necessarily commercial propositions, because I'm also interested in what I brought, ones that have kind of gone bust.
That's good.
I was kind of inspired by, I've been reading Alan Hollinghurst's The Line of Beauty recently, and the magazine OG that only had one issue. And it was a kind of a whimsical Coke child of these two people that they kind of produced just one single thing, and then one of them died and it took them years to do it. So I like the idea of people coming together and doing something, and it doesn't really have a business model at all. Mm. So the other things I brought are Le Gun magazine, which was set up by a group of illustrators at the Royal College of Art, who were in my year when I studied there. And they've done about 4 issues over about 6 years. But that kind of defined this kind of collective of what they were about, and it doesn't really have any words in it. It's just kind of complete illustration, but it kind of set up their whole agenda, really, and made them, it has spawned all these other things happening in the city as well.
Mm. And in terms of an agenda, what was it representing?
Well, I think for me, it kind of merged the idea of experiencing the city and how you might represent it. So in a way, like, all the boys looked like the boys in the East End with those funny sticky little legs where everyone was wearing skinny jeans. Mm. And there was that moment where you kind of walked around and everyone looked a bit like one of their illustrations. And yet on the backdrop, there would be their illustrations on billboards. And so it was this kind of merging of that happens at some points with the kind of art and life and experience and drinking in the city and having fun and
And how tight a team was this? Because when you set it up, I thought, okay, this is going to be 3 or 4 illustration styles, but it seems.
Yeah, I think there was 5 core members. And right. It was Neil Fox and Robert Rubbish, I think, were the ones that I knew most, and they set it up. But it's been quite inclusive. I mean, I think they invite other people to be involved.
Mm. It's A5 and it's A3 in format, I would say. Fantastic paper stock. And what I really like in the back is that they offer up all of the credits as a flat plan would do, which is really wonderful. And nothing sort of distracting from the pages as you go through in terms of credits, etc. Fantastic. Do you have another copy of it there or no?
I've got 2 copies of issue 3, and then they've all sold out, the other 2, so you
right.
can really get them.
Brilliant. Aaron, let's maybe move beyond people being a little bit offbeat.
I was going to bring up Huck with the documentary photography special, and that goes back a little bit to what Poco was saying. But this is a really interesting issue. It's really different from the other ones they do. They usually do more kind of, I guess, alternative lifestyle, like surfing and cultural type skateboarding, that type of stuff. But this is all about documentary photographers that they've either worked with or who they enjoy. And they've allowed them to kind of write a short sort of intro and then have a photo essay. And they talk about the issues that they've kind of photographed. And then I think there's a 3-part section where they've taken people in the documentary photography sort of world to write about the state of the industry now. So that's kind of stuck in between these really beautiful essays. So it's just a really kind of amazing, like, kind of capsule of where photography's at today, who's really kind of making waves, and it's just really beautiful. I just found it really inspiring.
Go ahead, Will.
I was just thinking that looks so much more sophisticated than the poker one. In terms of, you've just flicked through it and it looks like the photography is kind of
amazing. Stunning, yeah. And they're all fairly young photographers, but you'd never know. I mean, they're world class photos, and the a lot the essays in here that are talking about where photography's at and how photographers can make money in this world where they say everyone's a photographer. You know how that makes photographers kind of squirm. Actually, it shouldn't. And they talk about that specific issue. So it's interesting. And then that goes right into this stunning photo essay about the last days of youth and kind of coming of age, or climate change in India. Elizabeth Dalziel's essay is really beautiful. That's my favorite one. You know, it's really good, really well done.
Pass that across
for a second. Yeah, sure.
Where do they end up if you've been through all the articles? You know, in terms of photographers being able to sustain themselves and get good commissions, and hopefully, you know, get other ones, because I mean, obviously, this is such a huge issue that there are so few magazines today which want to, you know, not just pay the page rates, but also the insurance and everything else, particularly
exactly.
when people are going to edgier parts of the world.
Right. Well, I think I kind of took from it that you do have to stay on top of where everything's at. And you know, there's a time and a place for people to stay in like the really traditional old school photo journalism type photography. But there's also, right now, there is a pressure for photographers to realize they are professionals, but you do have to kind of understand, you know, what the different formats are and what other people are doing. And so it's almost kind of a push to photographers to kind of stay on top of that curve. Mm. But I just thought this issue is really great because, you know, it tackles an issue, a massive issue, while also, you know, showcasing talent. And it's just a really good way to kind of do that. I think Boat tries to do that a little bit in that, like with the Reykjavik issue, we brought up a lot of the problems and the big issues that the world is facing, but in a tiny kind of scale, which is Iceland and Reykjavik. And I think Huck did that really well in this issue.
Mm. Will, does it appeal? Well, it was certainly.
I think it was very nice. Yeah.
You've already stuck the knife into Poca anyway, so.
I think that the ones you've brought are very. The photography, I mean, you just. The way the graphic design allows the photography to speak for itself, I think is great.
Yeah.
Mm. It made me think you saying that, you know, people say everyone's a photographer. Actually, now with blogs, people say everyone's a writer, but I think actually they're not.
Right.
The good thing is that what I think magazines do is have editors that allow people to differentiate and give hierarchy to what is important and what isn't.
Well, right. That's good, both of you, from a commissioning point of view, but Will, you know, certainly where you've been, architecture firms, they want to be precise and they want to have the most accurate and hopefully the most you know alluring representations of their work. So so many of them have their house photographers and obviously they're pitching to your art desk. And I'm wondering, you know, for you, is it always about intake or also on the other side, you know, sending out your own people to go and document this? Because I'm not saying it's about covering and patching over the warts, but I think that's oftentimes when you look at good architecture journals as well, and there is that sort of true critique, you don't have the sleight of hand that can come if it's in the hand of that great firm's own art department.
I think it's really, we always try and send writers to go and see the building, and that the criticism is, you know, informed by being there. But I think it's, with budgets now, it's very difficult to send photographers all around the world to take different shots. So you do end up using a lot of the ones that people do send to you. And also in architecture, you need the permission of the person to publish it, really. It's not like a film where you can just send someone to watch it at a cinema. You need to have the drawings, and the architect has to cooperate with you. So it's quite difficult to be very critical at times. It's always kind of, you're always in bed with them slightly.
Really? But that's fascinating. Are there any titles on the market, though, that have sort of made a name by just being generally rude?
I mean, we are quite rude, but then you have to take into account, well, they might not speak to us for 10 years.
Right. Which, but there's plenty of firms out there, so it's not a problem. I just want, on your side, the commissioning process, how does it work with photographers? So do you land in Kyoto, do you feel it's essential that you have to work with three or four local photographers and then also bring in your own people as well?
Yeah, we started the Sarajevo issue, the first issue, we started as a way to kind of let the people that we worked with who are really talented kind of have a blank slate and just work on whatever they wanted to. So we kind of let them loose in the city. But we realized that there has to be a balance between the inside and outside view of a place. So we definitely work with locals and try to get their point of view in both visually and through the writing as well.
Mm. And yeah. Are they able to then sustain a relationship after that, or do they become part of the mix?
Some of them have. I mean, the thing we've been able to do, because we do one issue there and then, you know, we haven't come back to the same city yet. What we can do is a lot of times we get people saying, oh, can you give me the contacts for the for a photographer we used in Athens who's Athens based, and then we can send her work through that. And that's happened quite a few times when other publications are saying, we need something done there, but we can't get there. Can you recommend someone? So, and that's been great.
Erin, we're going to go away for a very short break. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. Back in a moment.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got The Curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
And you're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. We cross now to Italy's other capital of design, Turin, whose industrious, modestly brilliant design studios have been long wowing Europe. The city is also Italy's publishing capital and has a flourishing community of graphic designers to fill those blank pages. One such designer is Roberto Necco, who's recently featured an artist in Un Sedicissimo, what has now become a cult title for Italy's designers and publishers. Roberto talked through the edition with our David Pleasant at his Turin studio.
This publication is called Un Sedicesimo, literally 1/16. It means the number of the pages, because you know that in the printing industry, 16 pages is one minimum unity of measurement, because the 16 pages is the typical unit of printing. And this is a publication from Corraini, which is an important publishing house in Italy. And this is a magazine very particular, because every month they ask to a graphic designer to fill these 16 pages in the way they want, completely free. So they are free to fill these pages, exposing their thinking, their project, or what they want, completely in freedom.
And we should say that this is, it's not just a kind of artistic project, it's also a commercial project in a way. It's got a price tag on it of €5, and it's available in nationwide across Italy.
Yeah. Also in Europe, but especially in Italy, yes. In the bookshop of the museums, in particular bookshops, in specialized magazine shops, artistic shops, and... It has become, today we are about at the 30th number, and it's a little cult object between designers and between graphic designers.
And let's talk about how you filled those 16 pages. Let's look at the cover. So you've gone for very bold colours, a lovely green. I don't know why, it does look quite Italian, that green. Do you know, what kind of green is that? I don't know how you'd call it.
It's a green of a grass. Of Italian grass, because the title of this issue is "The Designer Do Another Chair," because we have this sort of stress about designers. The designers are constrained to do chairs, so the title is "The Designer Do Another Chair." And in central spread of the review, there is the poor designer is fulfilled with chairs in a big grass, and is thinking about his life, very desperate. Oh no. I'm doing another chair, so...
So we don't need any more chairs, is what you're basically saying.
Probably we don't need any more chairs, just too much chairs.
And you've kind of, page by page, you've done a little joke, a little kind of joke. Let's look at the first page. If we open that page, tell us in Italian what that says.
Gli avvocati fanno un'altra causa.
Which means?
The lawyers do another cause.
Another case. So another case. So lawyers always making cases.
Yes.
And there's two of your illustrations with some kind of industrial scenario happening, and then a naked female form. Let's look at the next page. What's the next page?
Gli architetti fanno un altro palazzo.
So there again, there's an architect, and then there's another building, yet another building that they've created.
Yet another building. Yes, in fact, there's no a direct relationship between the images and the text. It's a sort of nonsense about the repetition. That means that, in fact, every one of us do in his life, do every day the same things, or quite the same things. And this is a sort of explanation of the repetition of our life. And especially in designers, they seems to be the more creative of all of us, but also designers do everything chairs. So,
so. And perhaps just kind of to contextualize, we're here in your studio in Turin in a quiet courtyard off one of the main streets of the city. Does your studio and your space kind of reflect a little bit about what you do? I mean, how have you chosen your work environment?
Yes, of course. This is sort of refugee for me. I need this because I need to have quiet places. I need to have a place in which I can express myself and sometimes to go out from the town, even if I am inside the town. So yes, of course, it reflects my kind of work, my way of work.
And another way you express yourself and another form of that is that you play the banjo. Tell us a bit about that pastime of yours.
Oh, well, yes, playing banjo is a passion, of course, it's a collateral passion, but it's important for me because it's a sort of switch in my mind. When I play the banjo, I play the banjo, and when I draw, I draw. And I think it's two things that's insuspectably complementary. I don't know.
Unexpectedly complementary.
Complementary, yes. It seems that playing the banjo for me is necessary for drawing, and drawing necessary for playing banjo, because the two things that really are very close for me in my mind.
Banjos in the Piemonte, who knew? That was our David Pleasant in Turin talking to the graphic designer and artist at Un Sedicissimo magazine. You are listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. I wanted to, I see colors at the top of your pile, so I will go to Veneto. I guess that title still being edited out of Treviso, Aaron. I can't see, is it a recent issue that you have? Or
this is from spring 2013.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's on top of your pile there for what reasons?
Well, I was just going to say, this has kind of been a revelation for me, I guess, this year. And Patrick Waterhouse, who took it over, he's now editing it. And I just think it's incredible what they've been doing. I feel like it's the work they're doing really through it is really important in terms of tackling an issue and doing it in a really interesting way, so that they almost kind of come at it from every angle that you can, and then you're left to sort of make up your own mind. So the issue that I have is about news, and they start at one place and then kind of go off down rabbit trails. And there's this point in here in this issue where they have a photograph of a girl who had, I believe it's in Pakistan, where she stole some photo frames out of a shop, and she came out of the shop. And they knew that she'd stolen them, and she was shot and killed on the street. And it shows you the photograph from all the different publications that printed that photo. Mm. And it shows it, then that you turn the page and it shows it from 13 different perspectives. Then you turn the page again and it's a photo of all the photojournalists standing over her and taking the photo of it. And it just is almost a step back. It's almost kind of disconnects you from the news, so that you're able to then look at it and see how it's made and what is actually happening. And I just think it's, this issue really has stuck in my head in terms of the media in America and the UK, and sort of how, particularly in America, and how it is so biased, and this really helps you sort of see how it's made and the kind of structure behind it.
I mean, these incredible spreads they have within this very clever reveal. It's sort of like a booklet right. size, sort of A5, or as you said, they show you the full image. This one being that rather dreadful, you know, bloodied image after the shooting and death of Muammar Gaddafi, and then how this, and of course that was such a big discussion at the time. You know, should that have been up on screens, mm-hmm. you know, moving image and otherwise? And then you see everything, you know, from Bildzeitung to, you know, to the Express to the Yomiuri Shimbun, all of these different newspapers displaying it. Well, yeah. do you think that you know, when you have, you know, here's one of the world's biggest fashion brands, perhaps the, you know, the original fast fashion brand. Do you see a disconnect, or do you see a legitimacy that they should have a voice in putting out a magazine like this in the form of Benetton?
I don't think there's any problem with it. I mean, I'm happy for anyone to put out magazines who's got the money to do it. So actually, it doesn't really matter. If you look at the ownership of any magazine too carefully, you'd probably run into problem. You know, if you were taking an ethical position on any ownership, you'd probably run into problems sooner or later.
Mm, absolutely.
And also, Benetton is a brand that's kind of known to do to break the mold of what people think they should do, and really a lot of the issues that they talk about in this magazine is doing that as well. So their first kind of issue that they tackled was race, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. And now the magazine does that, but just with lots of different arenas. Mm.
Does it relate in any way to the Fabrica, their design school?
Yeah.
It's mm-hmm. there's an attachment, I think, with their whole little compound or campus interview. So we probably have time, Will, for what, I mean, you've still got some fantastic titles out of your archive there. One more talk about.
I'll talk about Limb by Limb. So I brought along something else that is that was set up and then went bust, I think. And it was set up, it wanted to be a mix between Loaded and The Spectator, covering everything from tantric sex to politics. But I think, how could that possibly go bust? Surely we need a magazine like that. And it did about 8 issues.
Oh, what year? I can't see.
It's in around 2000, 2001. Mm. And in the final issue I've got, it's got a great advert for Limb by Limb is about to undergo a big change, and it's advertising for writers, assistant editor, sub-editor, designer, illustrators, cartoonists, animators, picture researchers. So it's got about 12 different jobs, and then I don't think it ever published anything again.
Right, can I see that? Talk about a cautionary tale.
So this great optimism at the end of the year.
Right. And they appeal why?
Because it was cool. The strapline was young urban thinking, and actually right. It was funny. You know, actually we engaged with the city in a different way, and it showed you, you know, where you could take a slash late at night, the best alleyways in London. And it just was fun, actually. There's so few magazines that you read that are funny, actually. Mm.
I'm just looking at, this rather remarkable Lucky Pants story. But there's something about the feeling about it as well. And when you bring these titles, you know, out of the vault, it really, God, it just really sort of represents a moment in time.
It's a period piece.
It is. And yeah. I mean, even from a reproduction point of view.
Yeah, completely.
And, and yet, you think, God, 2001, it's not that long ago, but it actually feels like it's 2 decades ago. And there was one more, though, we probably don't have too much time for it. And that was Art World.
Art World, which was from not that long ago, but I think they did about 10 issues as well, 2007, around then.
Right.
And what I really liked about it was it had 50 pages of new work from artists, and it was just interviews with artists, and it just showed lots of their work just really cleanly. And actually, it kind of bypassed the critic, which is an architecture critic I maybe shouldn't say, but it's quite nice to be able to just read what artists think about their own work and not have to go through all the interpretation.
Just a question to both of you before we go. How often do you do a cull and maybe feel that, I don't want to be holding on to my copies of My Limb anymore and they need to go? Or is it just ever expanding?
Yeah, no, I don't do one very often.
No.
I kind of keep everything.
Aaron, you?
Same, yeah. I haven't thrown anything away.
No, it's bad. I know that we've got lockup somewhere out in Acton, more and more magazines.
Exactly.
To both of you, thank you very much for today. That's Aaron Spence. And the new issue of Boat, is when will the Reykjavik copy be out on newsstands?
The 22nd, next week.
Excellent. And also, Will Hunter, thanks very much for being on the program.
You.
Have a fantastic weekend. Today's show was produced by David Pleasant and Katie Bilboa, and the woman behind the glass, of course, that's that small homage, of course, to New Zealand as well, our studio manager, Claire Urban. If you have any thoughts or comments for us, then do drop us a note to info@monocle.com. Remember, we're back next Saturday at the very same time. Of course, we're going to be on a Nordic tour this week as well, so hopefully there'll be some interesting finds from Norway, Finland, Sweden, and beyond. Of course, you can always listen again via monocle.com and iTunes. But for now, for me, Tyler Burleigh, have a very good weekend. Goodbye.